Welcome to this session on sexuality. Doesn't have a specific title because it's a kind of general kind of thing that I want to invite us into tonight. At first, I just want to say something about this seminar that I was at. A number of people have asked me, well, what did you do with this thing? It was part of my continuing ed experience for the year. I basically participated in a week-long, very intensive, long-day kind of thing that seminarians are invited to do. It's something I had never gotten to do it before, so wanted to get in on that. And it's mostly Luther Northwestern Seminary students and United Seminary, which is an ecumenical seminary in the Twin Cities. It's basically the only thing of its kind done in the country, according to one of the leaders of it who was here in September. And it's basically called the Sexual Attitude Reassessment Week of Enrichment, I think it's the formal title. And it was led this time by Jim Nelson, who has written Embodiment in many other books that some of you may know of. And his latest one is about, how's it go, male sexuality, masculine spirituality, or vice versa. I always get the pairing wrong. And Marilyn Mason, who's a pretty well-known family systems therapist in the Twin Cities, and a number of other people. Some of the topics covered, just for your interest, and perhaps further conversation at other times, were pregnancy and birth, childhood and adolescence, fantasies and masturbation, sex roles and gender patterns, varieties of sexual expression, relationships, gay and lesbian sexuality, singleness, celibacy, middlelescence, which was the term we used for middle age, aging, sexuality and spirituality, touch, wellness, and massage, theology and homosexuality, sexual variations, sexual abuse, boundaries and intimacy, sexual anatomy and physiology, body image and theology, disability and sexuality, AIDS, sexuality and illness, pastoral counseling and sexual issues, professional boundary issues, sexual ethics, and church as a sexual community. It's pretty comprehensive, pretty long day, and the approach taken with these was pretty varied. We had everything from large group, which was about 80 people, including the participants and sometimes spouses or partners, large groups, small groups of about 10 people with a leader, some panels. We had panels on the topics of homosexuality, disability, AIDS, and some presenters like a seminary professor, a pastor, a lot of audiovisual things in the back of the room. There was just kind of an army of slide projectors and film projectors, and we had just a lot of visual things on a variety of topics, sometimes kind of all at once. You know, there'd be a few movies going and some slides flashing on the screen. One morning, particularly I guess among seminarians, has become known as Sexorama, or is the tape on? Or Fuckorama. kind of just a visual immersion, lots of different things all at once. But it was pretty comprehensive. And part of one of the goals of that time was to desensitize future pastors to a variety of issues of sexuality so that they could not be shocked when people talk about, feel comfortable talking about those things, and deal with their own feelings regarding a variety of topics. And that was what the small group time was focused on a lot. And I would just mention, out of some of that, some books, this was part of a course at Luther Northwestern, and some of the books that were recommended for them to read are all in our library. I was pleased to find, and if I maybe should let go of them and put them back in there, but Embodiment, we have several copies of, some classic that's been around for a while by Jim Nelson that covers a variety of aspects of sexuality and Christian theology. Sexual Violence, The Unmentionable Sin, An Ethical and Pastoral Perspective by Marie Fortune, who has done a more recent book on, another book being Sexual and Celibate by Keith Clark. Between the Sexes, Foundations for a Christian Ethics of Sexuality by Lisa Cleaver. And Is the Homosexual My Neighbor? Another Christian View by Scanzoni and Mollenkopf. And I think we have a number of other good things in the library here, too. I also, for those of you who are interested, could make available to you, we got a number of bibliographies. A Bibliography of Religious Publications on Sex Education and Sexuality. Human Sexuality, A Bibliography for Everyone. Human Sexuality, A Selected Bibliography for Professionals. Some handouts on AIDS that I didn't make. A real helpful sheet on incest continuum. And then these principles basic to education for sexuality. And I want to just read a little bit from that as kind of a background. To give some setting to what we're talking about. I've been struck in being here for 1.5 winters so far. I want to separate the winters at Holden from the summers. And the summers, you know, we have, some of you know what summer at Holden is like. We have lots of folks come in from all over the place and lead sessions on a variety of topics. Well, when we bring in people to help us talk about things, we talk about some issues of sexuality. But in the winter community, I've been struck in the last 1.5 years when we don't bring people in from the outside, how little we talk about sexuality. Maybe because we can't get anybody to do it for us, or maybe because it's a topic that we just have a hard time with. A topic meaning, I mean, a very broad range of things. And perhaps one symptom of that is, I had mentioned this book to someone recently, and being sexual and celibate, and they just kind of laughed, like, how could that be? How could you be sexual and celibate? And I think that's an example of how we get sexual and sex mixed up. And the comprehensiveness of who we are as sexual people. One quote that was on our schedule for this seminar said, authentic spirituality takes into account the total life of the spirit, soul, and body as the way we see God, self, and others. Not only is sexuality comprehensive, but I think hard to separate out from spirituality. Maybe we could spend a minute. How would you define sexuality? An organization on sexuality that deals with sexual education, I think mostly sexuality education, and I don't know the CECUS, I don't know the acronyms, but they said that the concept of sexuality refers to the totality of being a person. It includes all of those aspects of the human being that relate specifically to being boy or girl, woman or man, and is an entity subject to lifelong dynamic change. Sexuality reflects our human character, not solely our genital nature. As a function of the total personality, it is concerned with the biological, psychological, sociological, spiritual, and cultural variables of life, which, by their effects on personality development and interpersonal relations, can in turn affect social structure. Another definition that was shared at the seminar was, sexuality is, in the broadest sense, the energy that finds physical and emotional expression in the desire for contact, warmth, tenderness, and love. As Christians, we know that we have an incarnational faith. And one thing Jim Nelson said, which I thought was great, he said, to the everlasting embarrassment of high-minded spiritual people, the truth became flesh, not doctrine or theological formulation. What I want to do tonight, and there's a little bit of risk in this, and I want to speak to that just for a second, is do something that maybe some of you have done on a variety of topics where you someone says a statement and you have to indicate whether you agree or disagree and how strongly you agree or disagree by placing yourself physically in these locations. Here's the spectrum, -3 to +3. And notice there's no zero. Okay? And you may want to be at 0.0 on some of these, but you're going to have to nudge yourself one way or the other slightly. The risk in my mind with this is that these are statements that we have to kind of take a moral stand or a value stand. And that pushes us right away, I think, into this sort of right and wrong mindset. It's probably not the best place to begin in talking about sexuality. I think that's where the church has often been. There's some interesting stuff about the the penitential manuals in the Catholic Church for years were filled with sexual sins. And we know that the church has often given inordinate attention to our sexual life. If you said someone was arrested for immorality, you might think first of sexual behavior rather than cheating an employee or something. And often in the past in the church there's been 12 sexual rules for behavior to every one rule about economic behavior, for example. But I think this exercise is one way to just kind of simply name some things and get them out on the table and get us talking and wondering. And I'm hoping that tonight can be the beginning of just lots more conversation in this community about a variety of aspects of sexuality. And for me, the important thing is us sharing feelings and perspectives more than trying to sort out right away what's right or wrong. And so that's kind of the caveat I want to share prior to doing this. It may be that we want subsequent conversations to be a lot about sexual ethics, or they could be about other aspects of sexuality. And certainly one of the questions I have is, what would it mean for the church to take seriously itself as a sexual community? What would that mean in terms of our preaching and worship, in terms of our education, in terms of our social action and witness, in terms of our pastoral care, all of that? So, with all of that, I'm going to use basically the same statements that we used in this seminar, which, by the way, was just something we did like for, a half hour toward the end of this whole week. So the emphasis was not on the right or wrongness of various things. But I was drawn to it as something that got us talking, and it was really interesting to see how things shifted and laid out where, and I can share some of that with you about certain questions, what happened. I encourage you to not feel uncomfortable about maybe standing somewhere all alone at one end of the continuum on some of these statements. And to acknowledge to each other that that's just kind of where we are today. To not feel sheepish about that. Some of these will be stated in the positive, some in the negative. Some of that's just to get us moving around so you just don't stay in the same place for all of them. Some might not be totally clear. You may want to say, well, but you want to clarify the statement. Well, just take it as is and do with it what you can.
Okay, that's it.
It is more morally justifiable for married partners to have extramarital sex if they have given each other permission to do so. Any observations and feelings about that exercise?
Just the questions before you even think about saying something.
Why did they make you feel uncomfortable?
Felt judged.
Yeah.
Felt judged.
Judged by the other people who would see you taking a stand?
Uh-huh. It's a lot different than storing yourself on a piece of paper or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess one's aware of how little you thought about it.
Did you notice anything in the kind of how people lined up, or any tendencies, or any things that you were surprised at, or found predictable in terms of groupings? Or
I think that this community is. I think that you wouldn't find the same response in a normal Lutheran community.
See, it was a little skewed, you thought.
Yeah.
There was more diversity than I
expected. I was just going to say, I think there's a lot more diversity here.
I think maybe one of the reasons for it, though, is that there's a high level of trust here, too. I think people might be a lot more pressured in a place where they know that these are going to be people that are going to be around the rest of their lives. And
you never know.
But they know in other ways, but the trust level is just not the same.
One thing that was really striking when we did this seminar was the question on, first of all, I should say that Luther Northwestern students are all Lutheran pretty much, and United Seminary in the Twin Cities is ecumenical, UCC, Presbyterian, some members of MCC, Metropolitan Community Church, Gay and Lesbian Church, I mean, just a real variety of perspectives, but they tend to be probably churches that are not seen as being quite as, mainline or orthodox as Lutherans. And in the small groups, one person said, the Lutheran Northwestern students keep wanting to talk about the theology of things, and the United students just want to affirm each other. Affirm each other where they're at. And it was interesting that on the question of... same-sex genital relations are inherently deficient compared with opposite-sex genital relations. The only people on the plus side that agreed with that in our group, and it was pretty much half men and women, were men and Lutheran. And someone else observed, and many of them were married. And then I noted that on the question of non-marital sex between persons 15 to 17 years of age for the purpose of expressing love is morally justifiable, some of those same men were over on that side agreeing with that.
What was the first question again?
Same-sex genital relations are inherently deficient compared with opposite-sex genital relations. All those people were male and Lutheran.
Who agreed with that?
Yeah. And then the second one, where I noted that some of the same people were over there agreeing, was non-marital sex between persons 15 to 17 for the purpose of expressing love is morally justifiable. At one level, I think it's pretty understandable that people... Jim Nelson at this seminar said that... homophobia is often connected with misogyny, hatred of women, and it's usually stronger among men. And then I think the second question, it almost kind of felt like a macho thing, where these men over there kind of saying, oh, sure, it's okay to have sex with these younger ages. And there's a connection there.
I don't know, I thought that question about inherently deficient needed a lot of explanation. I know I interpreted it in one way, but I also said, but if this, then I'd be way over here.
Mm-hmm. I don't see how anyone would know unless they're bisexual and really felt that mentally for both. It's not just physical, I would get, you know, it's mental too, and if you're, you know, how would anyone who wanted to find out, who tried both but was mentally very heterosexual or mentally homosexual, how could they couldn't get an objective? I just don't see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also think that although the conclusion that you draw there, Carol, from what was represented at that seminar is probably reasonable. I think given the great variability in definition of many of those questions, also simply some of the confusion, there were several double negative questions and they were simply hard to understand. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be really, really tenuous to draw any kind of social conclusion based mm-hmm. on how people responded. I think it is much more useful as simply an awareness raising tool. I think it is much less effective as a demographically pointing tool.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting then, I was watching real closely then on that question to see what happened here, and it wasn't all males.
But again, I would feel that even for this group, it would be hard to really point.
To draw fine conclusions.
Yeah, to draw even general conclusions.
Yeah, it was just pretty striking. Well, other comments. Are there some of these questions that you'd like to, or statements that you'd like to talk about a little bit, share some of your comments about or thoughts that you had? I can just read these through and see if there's some things that you remember that you wanted to mention. I mean, obviously we can't do a thorough exegesis of all these. Sexual intercourse is morally justifiable only within the context of legal marriage. And I think their legal marriage, we have to assume, then excludes same-sex unions. And I think that's one of the catches in that statement, say legal marriage. Whatever two consenting adults do sexually with each other in private is morally justifiable.
I was curious how many people maybe were at different places when that one was compared with the one about the masochism.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that kind of the same thing? Mm-hmm.
I wonder if people gave any thought, at least from the standpoint of health, because there are some very unhealthy things that can be done between two people sexually that I find morally unacceptable.
Gentle relations are morally justifiable only if they are expressions of love.
There again, the question in my mind is, what is a gentle relation? How is that defined?
Yeah. Intercourse? I mean, is that what you're talking about?
What is love?
I actually have an easier handle on that. I have an easier handle on that than I do genital relations.
What's an expression of love?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's defined by each individual person. So it's your own definition.
Well, love, yeah, love I see is, you know, that, well, you can argue that one's if denounced, but I'd like to look a little bit more on genital relation. What is that? Because the idea that the question that came to my mind is that, you know, on a pap test, that's where one person is interested in the condition of another's genitals. Is that a general relation by that definition? I was just confused.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that in the context of the question, that's not what they meant.
That's a relationship being something that's mutual, you know, that's that's not just the doctor and the patient. I mean, I see it being something mutual.
Reciprocal.
How about, yeah, how about touching or caressing genital areas as a, while expressing love to each other? Any any touching or caressing or contact in those areas during expressing love? That's sort of what I interpret.
Intentional stimulation, sure, solely for that purpose of stimulation.
Well, or no, no, for communicating, I think, well, yeah, okay. Because then the question, yeah, because the question reads what is only justifiable.
Gentle relations are morally justifiable only if they are expressions of love.
Right, and so that that touching and caressing is morally justifiable only when it's a an expression of love. Mm-hmm.
Well,
this may
blow it
out. So that, yeah.
What if it was an expression of somebody, but the other person receiving it didn't want it to be expressed?
But I think that's what the question says, is that, that if that isn't happening, then it isn't morally justified.
Somebody got me love.
Yeah.
Whatever that means.
So then one person is morally justified, and
the
other
person. Yeah.
This may be nitpicking, but does genital relations include a doctor's examination?
That's what
we see. I wouldn't think so. I would interpret that as normal.
No,
so that isn't a genital relationship.
Probably not in the spirit of the question.
No, that's just it. I think probably I'm muddling the issue, but again, I don't think I don't have a clear handle on what is meant by that.
Just having sex because you feel horny, not because you love the person, isn't that what it means? I mean that's how mm-hmm. I would interpret it. Simply
yeah.
because it feels good and
mm-hmm.
both people like it and
okay.
So they do, we don't love each other.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty
simple.
Yes.
And I assume that means in or out of a creative relationship.
After adolescence, masturbation is immature or selfish and not appropriate to healthy adults. Now let's not laugh. I mean, not everybody felt the same on that, and there's probably some other people who didn't want to take a stand. I think that's we have to be careful these days. Yeah.
I would like to say that I feel a lot better after I saw the results of that.
Actually, when I think about it, I think, you know, what's the alternative? A lot of sexually frustrated rapists, or, you know, in other words, maybe there's a healthy aspect to that, to avoiding taking it out on another person, going somewhere where it shouldn't.
Yeah, and I think that it is amazing how little masturbation is talked about, and thanks, Eric, for sharing that, because I think that probably there's other people who had the same experience. I think that's an example of what's really helpful about talking about different aspects of sexuality, that can be very liberating, as long as it's within the respects a person's boundaries in terms of self-disclosure and things. But let me just, on these kind of principles basic to education for sexuality that the sexuality group drew up, let me just read one about that. Sexual self-pleasuring or masturbation is today medically accepted as a natural and non-harmful part of sexual behavior for individuals of all ages and both sexes. It can help girls, boys, women, and men to develop an affirmative sense of body autonomy. It is a source of enjoyment and can provide an intense experience of the self as well as preparation for experiencing an other. Many persons, however, do not express their sexuality in this way, and this also is an individual choice. I think we've heard that there's a lot of mixed messages in the church about masturbation, and I don't know where those come from. Or I mean, I've grown up in a church that never said anything about it, so I don't think I think by the absence of talk about it, maybe have picked up some messages, but have not heard it specifically spoken about. But I think that's not true in all churches. Yeah.
Well,
Just real quick, in a Woody Allen movie, he once said he liked masturbation because it was the only time he ever got to have sex with somebody he really loved.
And really understands what works.
What?
And really understands what works.
I've talked to a lot of people who feel a lot of guilt over it. I mean, I remember my best friend telling me one time just how, just this, I mean, he was just so overcome by, you know, by guilt and how he thought it was just, you know, so terrible. And I remember we were just kind of talking through it and trying to look at, well, you know, what are the negative aspects about it, you know, and I mean, you know, there's ways where I think it could be very negative, but I don't know, I'm not sure. He's got a very conservative person anyway, so he's, as far as I know, anyway, he's very, I mean, I think he holds a lot of guilt over that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, people find it a lot easier to talk about sexual relations than they do about masturbation, just because it's more accepted to talk about loving another person as opposed to somehow loving yourself and taking pleasure in your own self and your ego or whatever it's considered.
Mm-hmm. I think it's part of the high school. You grow up in high school, it's kind of a, you know, the names come out, you know, you jack off or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I think a lot of the negative connotations come from that, too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there may be some of you who are wondering about, but is it Christian or you know, what does the Bible say about it? Maybe having a hard time articulating or admitting some of those questions. And we know that the Bible says some things about spilling seed and this and that. But, I don't know what to say about that exactly, except to say that I don't know of many Christian perspectives that speak against masturbation.
Wouldn't the Catholics speak against it on the kind of on the same grounds as the, you know, as the view on procreation?
I don't know what Catholics. Does anyone know what Catholics?
Yeah, it would be considered a venial sin
for Catholics.
Yeah, they would have to confess it.
Still.
Oh, well, I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, they have to be still.
I'm interested in some of the topics where we spread out because I noticed that about gay, some of the gay and lesbian related ones seemed to be where we had the most diversity. And for me, that kind of tied in with the dialogue that we had here before about, you know, gay and lesbian rights.
Should I keep reading? Go straight to some of those. Same-sex genital relations are inherently deficient compared with opposite-sex genital relations. Sexual orientation as such ought not to be a consideration in the matter of ordination to the church's ministry. Because God is no more male than female, I believe that we ought always try to use sexually inclusive language and imagery about God.
Well, I hate to be the one to say things because I said it before, but I did notice that everybody was pretty clear-cut on where they wanted to be, and there was quite a marked difference. So I really feel that some people ought to have something to say about it.
Well, the word always was kind of a...
Yeah, I think there are appropriate times to think of the feminine and appropriate times to think of the masculine side of God.
See, that crossed my mind because I think that says less about the question, but that is, what do we understand inclusive language to communion, does it mean gender neutral language? Or does it mean that when speaking about talking of God always, that would mean not necessarily at one particular time as compared to another particular time, but at all times, that there is emphasis on using the myriad of God, at least in the most recent publication about inclusive language use in the church. That's really what they talk about the definition of inclusive language to be, is not necessarily gender neutral, but speaks of the very broad myriad description of God, including both me and one for me. I think it has more to do with how do we define inclusive language.
If it were neutral, you'd be losing a personal pronoun, which I think it's a nice thing to have. I mean, just in a relational type of experience.
Or if we neuterized all of it, it wouldn't be sexually inclusive because it wouldn't be sexual in any way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Married persons with bisexual inclinations ought to have no same-sex genital relations.
I feel a need to object to the term marriage being assumed that that's a heterosexual relationship. I mean, I know it was for the purpose of this exercise, but I personally know about 10 or 12 people who are friends of mine that are married and are gay, and they consider themselves married, and the church that married them considers them married. Mm-hmm. And in some places, they would have some of the same legal rights as married partners do in the law, like insurance and so forth, as being recognized more and more like a common law marriage, basically. Mm-hmm. And as, I don't want to give the state that much power to define marriage as what the state sanctions. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to say that. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the same sex doesn't. I mean, that's what's been sanctioned by the marriage.
Mm-hmm. I think it matters in some of the other questions. I don't think it really matters that much in this question.
That's true. Well, no, it's assuming that it's not a same sex.
Yeah.
But the question wouldn't change.
What if you have same sex marriage and you had somebody with a different sex? I guess to me, I see the principle as the same thing.
In the question.
In the question, yeah.
If you're bisexual and you're in a marriage...
Bisexual is bisexual, whether you're married or heterosexual.
Yeah, you just have to change one word in the statement. Married persons with bisexual inclinations ought to have no same-sex genital relations.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would interpret it both ways, same or other, depending on...
Mm-hmm. It is legitimate to fantasize about having sex with one person while having sex with another.
What's legitimate mean?
Yeah. What would be a more helpful word there?
How about would you approve? Think of it that way. Would you think it's okay?
How would you like it?
No, I mean, would you think that it's somehow all right, that you could justify it to yourself? That's how I interpret it. As legitimate.
Would morally justifiable, in other words, it's been
that would be another.
Is that another appropriate? Yeah.
As long as you
don't say the other person's name. Out loud.
It seems to be less of a. If the sexual experience is. Giving love or making love to that person, then it would seem to me that there's not the same. When you're imagining another person, you're not reflecting the love of this action on the person that you're with.
Does morally justify mean that we got to check? To judge over something, or just justify? I mean, I think it's just sad if someone, but it's not, I mean, it's probably just in certain cases, and they're probably not enough or something. I don't know. But I don't know what morally justifying means. I mean, but if you're supposed to.
Would you be, maybe another word would be, would you find it okay? It is morally justifiable for married partners to have extramarital sex if they have given each other permission to do so.
We're already married then.
Unless you're concerned, I suppose, before you're staying married for the kids or you're staying married.
Well, sometimes there is sickness. Or there's some incapacity at times that happens in a marriage.
So what did you say?
It's sometimes there's within a marriage it could be either a sickness or a disability that occurs.
If the person who's disabled gives the permission for that other person, then it's okay.
I'm just raising that. Mm-hmm.
It's a love. It's a vow to love, honor, and obey. I think those things can happen with or without fidelity. I mean, fidelity can enhance those things, but they're not necessarily exclusive, mutually exclusive.
Read it again.
No, it says it with permission. Yeah.
It is morally justifiable for married partners to have extramarital sex if they've given each other permission to do so.
I just thinking that, so our Bible study was on.
Mm-hmm. This morning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't connected until. Mm-hmm.
Abraham and Sarah and Hagar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We seem to accept it this morning, okay.
I think we somehow assumed that as a society we assume that automatically means that that's going to break up the marriage. Or that it's somehow the first step in a separation. And I can envision, you know, two or three circumstances where that could be the highest form of showing that you love that person, was to allow them, for certain reasons, to have, say, hey, look, I mean, it's all right.
What type of situation?
Yeah, we have.
Disabilities. Say somebody was physically disabled, and you know, at some point during a marriage, the other partner certainly continues to have sexual needs and desires, and you know, if there was a high enough level of trust, why not allow that person to get those desires fulfilled?
But don't you think then that this person would eventually leave the disabled person?
That's what society automatically assumes. I think that there can be enough trust and love between two people.
But what about the person that the person's having sex with? I mean, what does that leave that person? Does that make the other person just kind of an object for the person, for the...
That brings up, of course, that brings up the question then, is sex without love all right? Sex for purely physical reasons.
Well, you can love more than one person at a time.
And that's the other converse to that, is that can you love more than one person sexually? And I think both of those, just my own personal opinion is that both of those can be possible.
That's true. I never thought
of that. It raises an interesting question in that what does the sexual act bring in reality to a covenant? To a covenant between two people. I mean, one can easily set up a very legalistic system to say that in the wedding vow, if you define the covenant as the wedding vow, then what that says then is that the sexual act belongs only in that marriage. But flip it around. What does the sexual act create in the covenant itself between two people who are engaged in that sexual act, a married couple? What does that that action of intercourse fuse in the covenant? You know, that's a question that I really wrestle with, and I think it comes back to this, because if we understood the nature of that better, maybe we could understand more about when the sexual act is appropriate outside the bounds of marriage. But I think we look at it the other way around, that you need to have the covenant then mandates whether you can be sexually active or not. Not saying if you are sexually active, what kind of covenant is created because of that.
I guess I'd like the clarification of what the word adultery means and what Jesus meant when he talked about do not commit adultery. What is the definition of adultery?
That's a good question.
Have we just done away with one of the Ten Commandments, or maybe would someone define adultery for me? Just to get it out of the book?
It would be real easy to yank out a dictionary and do it.
What's your definition of it, Barbara? What would be your definition of it?
The way I was taught, and unless it's changed, is intercourse outside of marriage is part of adultery. And then I always think about what Jesus said about looking at a woman. I don't have that passage right now. You know, he said that everybody commits adultery in their heart or something like that.
Well, he's talking about lust.
Lust, is that it? But what's your definition of adultery?
I don't have one.
What does the dictionary say?
Exactly what you did. Mm-hmm. Exactly what you did.
Does that apply before marriage or after marriage?
Yes, yeah, I assumed it meant after you were married.
Yeah. I think Jesus also wanted to protect the women of his time. I mean, the women, it seems to me, were quite abused, and I think maybe that's why he was talking about that.
Well, maybe the same thing stands for today.
One of the understandings that I have in Jesus' teaching of to consider yourself sinning of adultery when you actually look on another woman, I'm not sure exactly, but I would think of it as solely as a sexual, physical object. What I interpret that to mean more often is that it says to me that adultery speaks of abusing a covenant. Yeah. Abuse of covenant is what I understand a little bit about what adultery might mean. Jesus talks about even those desires of the heart that happen when looking at another a woman or another man.
let's not delude ourselves to say that those same kind of abusive thoughts can also take place in women.
Jesus was also notoriously soft on people who were adulterous, and he saved the woman from stoning. The woman at the well, when he didn't tell her to go back and marry the man that she had been having relations with other than her husband, or I can't remember the exact story, but he didn't tell her to go back and, you know, and marry this person.
But what did he say? He said, go and sin no more. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, okay.
What did Jesus mean by that? I don't have a clear answer.
That was to the prostitute, right?
Yeah, that's to the prostitute.
That's to the prostitute.
But did he say that to the woman at the well?
Yes. Yes.
Maybe he meant sin no more in that context. I mean,
yeah. What did he mean? To me, it said that it doesn't say necessarily that Jesus let her off the hook. It also says that whatever you've done thus far, you're okay. Whatever you do now is fine. I think Jesus was saying that there's something in your future that what you have learned now because of your past actions needs to be changed.
He did.
He accepted her. But said, go and sin no more. What does that mean? I don't know.
It meant that he didn't want her to hurt anymore.
ever again, be hurt again.
There's also an interesting difference between adultery and thought, if you want to think of it that way, where adultery is an act, and that's a significant difference. I don't think any of us is totally able to control our thoughts at all times. Things come into our mind we have no control. The deliberate act of adultery is something that's volition. That's quite a difference. An interesting difference.
My husband and I wrote our own wedding vows. This was about 10 years ago now. This guy put them on the altar and so we had a priest in the house. And they went along with all of our vows except one that we wanted to put in, and that was to be understanding when there would be times for the need for space. That was really
what did they interpret that to mean? That they objected to?
I think what we're saying now, they thought that it could be interpreted for the definition of the adultery.
I mean, it wasn't that simple for me for space, but you know, that's how they thought that he could be used to interpret it. And so,
what's a legal marriage vow these days? Is it legal to just say, I take this man to be my lawfully wedded husband? Is that all that the wedding vow is? Is that the legal wedding requirement?
You can do it.
Well, I mean, if that's all, because then the rest of it, I take this man. Gosh, I don't remember the name.
No, but I mean, to take the unto myself only as long as we both shall live.
I mean, is this not a legal part of the marriage?
I think that legal, it's a purely legal arrangement.
I take him to authorized and signs that you're married.
Yeah.
And it's properly witnessed.
And
you don't
say something out loud in front of somebody that heard you say that you want to take this man to be my
husband. And then you have the legal right to sue each other. One expression of the legal part of what that means. Yeah.
Well,
you can get it as easily. You can get married as easily as you get a hamburger. You can even do it on a drive-in basis in places like Reno. Just drive up and get the signed paper, and that's it. And it's binding legally.
The Gordon Lathrop, who used to teach liturgy at Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa, would say that marriage has nothing to do with the church. And in fact, one wedding I went to there that he did for two seminary students. Bonnie went there, maybe I'm just quoting him, correct me, but maybe you knew them, Jackie Charks and John Beck. When they got married, the vows, it started with the wedding outside the chapel. The vows took place outside on the steps, and then we went in for a full Eucharist service. But he would say that marriage takes place out in the world, and...